This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on November 10th, 2015. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The next item is item number 5, and the first part of this is the memorandum from Commissioner Goodman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Turning from comedy, I would like to take up a very serious issue, and that's one that I have expressed many times at this commission. I won't give you the speech again, because when this matter was first raised at the public meeting on October 20, I gave my speech about state and local parties. I reiterated it in an op-ed in the Washington Examiner on Monday of this week. So I won't belabor that, just to say that I believe there is a consensus in political science, in think tanks, among practitioners, that the parties need some regulatory relief so that they can be effective democratic institutions. Before you was originally document agenda document number 15-54A. You will recall at the meeting of October 20, I proposed a few small edits to that document at the table. They are located in the document section 1A. Those edits were discussed at the table on October 20th, as well as in section 1F. As a courtesy to the commission, I distributed yesterday an updated agenda document number 15-54-A1, and I added one provision at section 1B2. So I just by way of explanation, we can give political parties greater freedom to work with their candidates, I believe, within the grain of the statute, within the allowance of the statute, to allow parties to re-disseminate some materials by their candidates. There are two legal approaches, one that I had proposed, which was to expand the notion of what it means to be incidental or subordinate part of the party's own communication, and that's reflected in section 1B, little I. What I've added here is there is another legal theory that might give them even greater leeway, and that is to conform the language of 11 CFR 109.3782I to clarify that republication by a political party is not necessarily or per se a contribution, because the language of the statute is that republication is an expenditure. Congress chose that word advisedly, and that leaves open the possibility that republished materials could be an independent expenditure, and only if there's coordinating conduct would there then necessarily have to be a contribution inferred from the expenditure. I'm suggesting that, since this is a resolution to commence the work, that we have Office of General Counsel to develop both themes, both theories and approaches to it. And so I've merely added that to Section 1B, giving the two alternatives to look at republication, and keeping all of the work in 109.37, which is the party coordination regulation, and keep it self-contained in that section. I'm happy to answer any questions about this proposal if any commissioner has them, or I'll proceed to move document number 15-54-A-1.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that there are a couple of things going on in your proposal, one of which some of the changes, I think, could run counter to the direction that we got from the court in the Shays litigation when we initially, and this was before my time, the commission initially came up with very narrow definitions of what federal election activity would be, particularly as it pertained to the state party committees, and those regulations were struck down, and the court said you have to go a little broader than that. So, with respect to those, I don't know whether we actually can do what you're suggesting, whether it would withstand legal challenge, and I suspect it would be challenged. A number of your other suggestions, I mean, basically the import of them is to provide more wider exemptions for state party activity that's done in coordination in some sense, and I'll use that in the loosest, most colloquial sense at this point, with candidates, so that it would have the effect of providing some relief from the coordinated spending limits. And that, as you know, has been proposed numerous times on the Hill. It is actually a controversial subject on the Hill. It doesn't have bipartisan support. And as I pointed out last time, even the Brennan Center, when it talked about party relief, said that alleviating party coordination limits, they would not feel comfortable recommending until there was a stronger, more consistent enforcement of the rules that are on the books here at the FEC. So the Brennan Center doesn't actually think we're doing a particularly effective job of enforcing the law. And every article that I have seen about that talks about the parties talks about it, including the ones that you cite to in your op-ed, talk about it in conjunction with talking about super PACs. It's always a, sort of a yin-yang. The parties are suffering, and the super PACs are on the ascendancy, and the super PACs are doing all this stuff that people have concerns about. So I think that, you know, we have proposed on any number of occasions to go forward with something that was also the subject of some Hill discussion, and the answer we always get from your side of the table is, no, 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 we can't do that. We have to let folks on the Hill deal with that. It has to be done by legislation. And that happened as recently as last week when we had a petition in front of us. It had overwhelming public support, almost all of the comments, and we got thousands of them said, please go forward with this rulemaking petition. And the answer we got was, no, if something's going to happen in that area, it was the government contractor petition, we think the Hill would have to do it. So I could just stop there. I could just say, therefore, since it's this topic of discussion on the Hill and the Hill is divided on it, I think we ought to leave it to them. But actually, I'm willing to go forward to ask OGC to start drafting rulemaking if you're willing to address both sides of the problem. And as I said, I think both sides of the problem are what's going on with party committees and what's going on with super PACs. And that's why the chair and I have drafted a proposal to address super PAC coordination with candidates. And I don't want to speak for the chair, but I know that I would be happy if you wanted to elaborate on that, provide other alternatives to our proposal in the same rulemaking document. But I think this is one of those, you know, if you'll help me out, I'll help you out. If you are interested in asking the council to start working on drafting up a notice of proposed rulemaking on coordination issues that would address both your concerns about the parties and our concerns about super PACs, I'm with you. I'll do it today. But I'm not willing to do it in a one-sided fashion. So that's why we rushed that document onto the agenda today, so that you would, and I know you only saw it, we only got it out yesterday, and you haven't had a lot of chance to look at it, and I don't want to rush you on anything, but that's basically, that's my counterproposal.
I have to say I agree with Commissioner Weintraub in this. I think this is a bilateral issue. I've heard everyone from the lawyer for the Republican Party to you to others who came before us at our party meeting last year saying that part of the problems for state and local parties and the national party is because of the existence of independent expenditures and the unlimited amounts of money. And so there needs to be some relief for the committees, for the party committees. I don't disagree with that. I think that there needs to be some changes, although I don't agree with your federal election activity proposal for the same reason that Commissioner Weintraub spoke about. And while I want to do something about party volunteer activity, because I care a lot about grassroots activity and what the parties have done in that regard. It seems to me that some of the things that you have suggested here don't really relate to that, and so I have some concerns about that. For example, adding that direct mail means a mailing performed wholly by a commercial vendor. I mean, things like that don't really relate to volunteer activity as far as I can tell. I'm really open to any other ideas or thoughts that you might have about how to increase volunteer activity, because that, as you know, is something I care about. But I, too, think that because these issues are inextricably intertwined, that something with respect to coordination generally, together with your party coordination proposals and maybe a different look at volunteer activity, and we could ask council to look at that, would be something that I would also agree with.
Wow, that's a mouthful, and those are a lot of roadblocks being placed in the way of doing what we can do to help state and local political parties who have expressed at our last meetings and at our forum a request that we work and do what we can to provide them regulatory relief. Madam Chair, you say you want to help grassroots activities, you want to help the political parties, but you disagree with allowing them giving them greater working within the incidental exception that Shays itself gave us and said if it is incidental, it's permissible. This suggests that we start work by drafting around the concept of incidental grassroots voter identification, voter registration, and get out the vote activities. There can't be any more virtuous type of activity. And I'm suggesting we work within what the court in Shays gave us, which was an incidental exception, and that we have it drafted and that we put it out for comment. But, Madam Chair, you say you can't support that. Then you say you cannot support my proposals to increase more volunteer activity. What can be more virtuous than encouraging people to volunteer their activities, to participate in mailings and phone banks and the types of things that state and local parties do that we want to encourage? So you've just taken out numbers 2 and 3 of this proposal. Now, Commissioner Weintraub, you talk about coordination and lifting the limits. I'm not proposing that we limit the limits. That is a congressional act. It is going to take Congress to either change the coordinated expenditure limits or to eliminate them. I'm not proposing that we do that. In just a sec. I'm proposing that we work within the grain of prior AOs and MERS here to find ways within our regulatory wherewithal to allow them to work more closely with their candidates, to make them more relevant to their candidates, to give them causes and reasons and abilities to work together. We had an opportunity that I've addressed here, for example, the Lampson case, where the congressional candidate Lampson in Texas transferred money to the state Democratic Party of Texas. All of the money that came into Lampson was subject to federal limits. It was publicly disclosed. Lampson's transfer of money to this Texas party was fully disclosed. The Texas party then spent money apparently to do a mailing on behalf of Lampson. Now, where's the corruptive potential there? And we have within the grain of our regulations the ability to allow the Texas Democratic Party to provide a service to its own nominee for office. And it doesn't take an act of Congress to do that. Congress hasn't addressed that issue. Congress will in its due course address coordinated limits. But this doesn't get rid of those limits. It works within, this is a very modest proposal, allowing candidates to provide biographical information to the party, for the party to provide the biographical information in their own brochures, to share public polling data, which in and of itself is not inherently coordinating, and that's what the court said in the Christian Coalition case. I'm just saying we some of these are mere clarifications. This isn't all new legislation. So what I hear is strong objections to allowing the parties to work more closely with their candidates. I hear objections to bringing more volunteers into party headquarters to allow them to participate in phone banks and mail drives. And I hear strong objections to trying to use an exception that the court gave us in Shays, yes, to work to try to expand it. It may draw a lot of negative comment that it is facially unlawful, but we can begin to work with this in order to, if we're going to err on the side of regulation or freedom here, why don't we err on the side of working within the exception Shays gave us to fight for voter registration and voter get-out-the-vote drives and voter identification and passing out early ballots and harnessing voters early to the polls, which is what the parties do. You know, we just punished the Orange County Republican Committee with, I forget what penalty they finally agreed to, but it was about $30,000 for doing what? For getting out the vote, because they used Levin funds transferred to them by the California State Party. The federal government punished the Orange County Republican Committee to the tune of about $30,000 for registering voters and turning them out to the polls. There's something incredibly perverse about a law that does that. Punishes Americans for registering voters and turning them out to the polls. Here we have an opportunity to work within the grain of the law that Shays gave us. And yet all I hear is objections. Objection to that, objection to number two, objections to number one. Madam Chair, I move that the Commission adopt agenda document number 15-54-A-1, a resolution of the Federal Election Commission commencing work on a notice of proposed rulemaking focused on strengthening political parties, and that we get on with the work of strengthening the most democratic of political institutions we have in America today, the state and local political parties.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Boy, Commissioner Goodman, you ought to run for office. You are just so good at those stem winders. I hear all these objections. I said I wasn't sure it would withstand legal scrutiny. I think we've got to worry about that. But I said I would be willing to put every single one of your ideas out as long as you're willing to work with me at the same time. And that's the real problem, is that you only want to do what you want to do. You want support for your proposal. You're not willing to give support for my proposal. The import of expanding the volunteer exemption to the coordinated spending limits is that it effectively raises the coordinated spending limits. That's what I'm talking about. The way that these volunteer cases come before us typically is actually the volunteers are being used as window dressing. The volunteer materials exemption was put into place at a time when state party committees would typically, you know, have rooms full of volunteers stuffing envelopes and stamping envelopes, and people just don't do mail that way anymore because it's not efficient. So what we end up with are a series of cases where they bring in a couple of volunteers to move the bag from one side of the room to the other, and they say, is that enough? Is that enough to get us, you know, into an exempt category so that it doesn't, so that the cost of the mailing doesn't count towards our coordinated spending limit? That's what we're talking about, is how much money can be spent in coordination. I understand that you think there shouldn't be any limits on this. Congress passed a law in 2002 that said that certain state party activities are going to benefit the federal candidates on the ballot, and therefore they put certain limits in place. I understand you don't like that law, but that law is on the books. But as I said, I am perfectly willing to put every single one of your ideas in a notice of proposed rulemaking and out for comment, but you know, let's be even-handed about it. You know, I'd love to hear the same offer on your part, that you're willing to put my ideas out for public comment while I'm willing to put your ideas out for public comment.
Madam Chair. Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Walter.
Commissioner Walter, you.
I just wanted to say that I'm in sync with the concept of putting this out, but I also am in sync with the concept of taking a look and seeing what we could do with Commissioner Weintraub's suggestion that we take these other issues, which are getting just as much contention in the press and the public and everything else. Those issues are important. But in your comments, you didn't address those. So what do you think about commenting on her suggestion?
I'm sorry, could you?
I think the criticism was that there was negative reaction to your suggestions. But on the other hand, I don't think that's totally accurate. It's just, yes, we want to balance it out.
Okay. On the issue of coordination, they are nonlinear. It is a nonlinear response. The articles, by the way, Madam Chair, I have to correct you. When we had a forum, the Republican lawyer who spoke was John Phillippe, the chief counsel of the Republican National Committee, and he's here today.
Good morning, Mr. Phillippe. Welcome.
And I have a specific memory of him standing up saying that he was not here advocating the restriction of anybody else's First Amendment right under Citizens United or here criticizing Citizens United. That he agreed, as I agree, that we needed to strengthen the political parties of America long before Citizens United. Citizens United and the elevation of the First Amendment rights of certain speakers may have crystallized some of the weaknesses that the parties were suffering at the hands of current regulation. I don't support the strengthening of political parties because of the existence of Citizens United.
I wasn't suggesting that, and I wasn't referring to Mr. Phillippe. I was referring to somebody that I was on a panel with who's a well-known lawyer for the Republican Party.
You mean a different panel than our forum?
A different panel than the forum.
Again, on this issue of super PACs, I'm not going to restrict somebody else's First Amendment right just to free up the First Amendment rights of the political parties. They stand alone, need strengthening. And some in government view the First Amendment rights of all these speakers out there to be like a team of horses that we get to drive as government. And as the Supreme Court freed up some of the horses to run more freely in Citizens United, we're looking at the reins that we've got on the horses and somehow, well, maybe we'll give those horses a little bit more room to run. Oh, but we're going to reharness those horses and pull them back a little bit. I don't view it as government's role to ride the team of horses in free speech like that. I'm talking about one horse in this race, and that's the political parties. And they need regulatory freedom, and they needed it long before Citizens United. Second, tweaking around the edges of coordination with super PACs, indeed reversing in your proposal 4-2 votes that were held just last week at this commission, is not going to re-alter the playing field of speech between the parties and interest groups that engage in super PAC speech. It may tweak them on some coordination issues, but it won't fundamentally give the parties their relative rights against the super PACs. The problem, to the extent that articles discuss the problems with the super PACs, it's that the super PACs get to speak very loudly with resources that are unlimited while the parties are shackled with limits, as well as all of these other regulations. So it is not an antidote to the super PAC problem just to address coordination issues with the super PACs. The problem, to the extent it exists and it's a relative or competitive problem, is that super PACs got the right under Citizens United to speak with unlimited funds. So the competitive issue will still exist even if you address coordination with super PACs with new rules. What would be perhaps lateral, and what I was thinking we might get, what would be related and germane to this proposal, would be the proposal to begin also addressing the new accounts given to the political parties. Mr. Noddy has prepared a memorandum for the commission to consider, and that is agenda document number 15-54B, an outline of a draft NPRM implementing party-segregated accounts. I don't agree with everything in it or the rationale of everything in it, but if you want to take a comprehensive look at the subject that's on the table right now, we could marry up those two proposals and ask the Office of General Counsel to begin writing a comprehensive party rulemaking. Now, that would be linear, and that would be related and germane to this proposal. So that's my reaction to the hostage-taking that's going on with the coordination of super PACs. And I think it just has to be understood by anybody out there. I want anybody listening from state and local political parties to know who your friends are. They're on this side of the table.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Never mind.
Right. Did Commissioner Walter?
There's a motion pending.
Yeah. No, I know. Did you want to speak?
That's right. No, we can continue discussion and comment.
All right.
We can do it before or after the motion.
Okay, so there's a motion pending. Any further comments, questions? All right, all those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 All those opposed?
No.
No, for today.
No. Madam Secretary, that motion fails by a vote of 3-3 with Commissioners Goodman, Hunter, and Vice Chair Peterson voting aye, and Commissioner Weintraub, Walther, and myself voting no.
Madam Chair, just a comment. For those who care about the political parties who may be listening and watching this issue, I just want to assure you that this is round one in this debate. This is not the end of this debate. Thank you.
And I agree with that, actually. It should be round one, and that's what we were, I think, trying to say, that there is will on this side of the table, despite what you just recently said, to do something in this regard. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a little bit out of order, but since it still pertains to Commissioner Goodman's proposal, I'd like to make another motion. I move that we direct the Office of General Counsel to draft a notice of proposed rulemaking that would include all of the proposals that Commissioner Goodman has set forth in Agenda Document 15-54A, I believe, as well as the proposals that the Chair and I put in 15-54D, and as I said, we are open to any other proposals on these topics that that our colleagues would like to include in that rulemaking document. There's a lot of characterizing of. Oh, I'm sorry. There's also I'll also include 15-54A1, which I guess was your revision of your original proposal. I don't want to. I'm trying to include all of your most current ideas in my proposal. There's a lot of characterization of other people's views, which some on your side of the table seem to take exception to, but I guess not all. You can set it up and say, well, my proposal is linear and yours isn't. You know, that's your view of it. But I think a lot of people out there would think that the issues that we're trying to bring up on coordination indeed ought to be discussed in a way that includes all of these coordination issues. And I don't know that there's any greater logic to saying that we're going to talk about party issues in this rulemaking as opposed to we're going to talk about coordination issues as they affect parties and other entities in another rulemaking. So, you characterize it your way, I characterize it my way, potato, potato, motion on the table.
All right, are there questions, comments?
Yes,
about
Madam
the motion?
Chair.
Yes. Commissioner Goodman.
I got this around 5 o'clock yesterday. I believe it came around 4:30, and I think I didn't look at it till late in the afternoon, so I barely had a chance to skim it. But if I understand it right, it would reverse decisions that we made last week.
We'd like to put that out in a rulemaking context for consideration. I think the view was expressed at the table last week that some of those decisions might be more appropriate in the rulemaking context. So they don't reverse anything. They just put them out for comment. The main thrust of the document is to take a look at the relationship between candidates and super PACs, particularly single candidate super PACs. Certainly a week doesn't go by, and sometimes it seems like a day doesn't go by when I don't read an article in the paper suggesting that candidates are just making a mockery of the lines between themselves and their and these single candidate super PACs that are out there supporting them. It appears that they are acting very much in partnership with one another, and some of us think that's an important problem that we ought to address in a rulemaking context.
May I inquire about the definition of election-related spending?
Sure.
You would include in coordination an organization's spending on candidate research and polling?
I believe that is election-related. But as I said, you could put
candidate
forward
research,
another
alternative. No, if a nonprofit organization wants to research candidates in their voting records in order to put out candidate scorecards, for example, or how candidates have voted on the issues that matter to us, would that fall? Would that now be regulated as coordination?
Well, if that organization has an employee, independent contractor, or founder who's the candidate's immediate family member or who previously was employed by or worked as an independent contractor for the candidate or a committee authorized by the candidate in the past year, or has received fundraising support from the candidate, the candidate's campaign, the candidate's immediate family member or staff in the past year, or shares a common vendor with the candidate and the common vendor provided any of the services listed in 11 CFR 109.21D42, or has been publicly identified by the candidate as a vehicle for supporting that candidate in the past year. But as I said, this is a proposal. If you want to add alternatives, happy to consider them.
I just have never, you're asking me to vote for something that came around 5 o'clock yesterday, and I'm just trying to consider some of these issues. That means if a nonprofit organization has an employee who also works at a campaign and conducts research in order to publish a voter guide, that nonprofit organization would then be guilty of coordinating with the candidate?
Only if one of these other factors that I just read out was also true.
That's what I said. If an employee is common, employee works for a nonprofit group, also works for a campaign, and then the nonprofit group decides to research candidates' voting records in Congress and publish a voting guide, then the voting guide, the expenditure on that would be coordinated under this proposal?
That is the proposal that we would put out for comment.
I think nonprofit groups would have great concern about this, that all of a sudden...
But they'll comment on it then. And I let me apologize again for getting it to you so late in the day. The reason that we got it to you was because you had been pushing to have a vote on your proposal, and as I have explained, I think it's only half of the problem that we need to address. So we wanted to put something in front of you. And if you want more time to think about it, I'm happy to withdraw my motion and we can bring it back to the table next time.
I guess what I could have benefited from is a presentation of it and a walkthrough of the document before I was called on to vote for it. I did that with my party proposal on October 20th. I walked through it. I know I got some grimaces over here, but I walked through it point by point, and I even cited advisory opinions and MERS statements from which the ideas came. I think it would have, we could benefit from at least having this explained at the table before I'm asked to vote on it.
Well, it draws heavily, if this is helpful to you, from not only a proposal that I had put before my colleagues a long time ago, but also from Richard Berfalt's work at Columbia and the recent rulemaking that was done by the California Fair Political Practices Commission.
Yeah, it might also be helpful for the public to have had a little bit more time to consider this
As I said, I'm happy to put it over to the next meeting. The only reason I put it on the agenda at this point that the chair and I did was because we wanted to pair it up with your proposal.
If we could put this over, that would probably be helpful.
We'll do that, and I'll get to you, Commissioner Hunter, in a minute. But with regard to the basis for it, and Commissioner Weintraub spoke to this, Professor Brefault testified before this commission and talked some about this. He's filed comments as well, and he's written a number of law review articles. He's well-respected.
Was that
academic.
In connection with the February hearing?
Yes.
Okay,
and
I'll pull his comments.
And he's also spoken, he's also commented to the commission extensively. So there's a lot of material in the public record at the commission with regard to his ideas. Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you. With respect to the notice of availability that the commission voted to put out in, I think it was June, as you know, that was originally a proposal by Commissioners Weintraub and Chair Ravel. They withdrew it, and then it was filed by Public Citizen. And there's one area of that notice of proposed rulemaking, paragraph 4, ensuring the independence of independent expenditures. And the only overlap that I see, just reading it very, very quickly, and I could have missed something, or the main overlap, I should say, is in the last paragraph, the commission should also adopt rules that deem all spending by outside groups that effectively operate as, quote, the alter ego of a candidate as coordinated spending, and drops a footnote to Richard Brefault's article in the Columbia Law Review. And so does this proposal supersede the notice of availability? Are you planning on voting no when that comes before the commission? Because it seems to me that this is a sort of a more detailed proposal of the what I criticized then as just very vague notions of how to fix things, and as I said at the time, I didn't think it was useful for the public to comment on ideas that were way too vague and broad. So it seems to me that maybe this supersedes the consideration of that. Am I right?
Well, no, because although I'm interested to hear that was your perspective, I thought your perspective was that you didn't want to support it because I wasn't a person.
No, that was yours. But, that wasn't the second one.
Well, the second one has been submitted now by Public Citizen and
right.
by Sy.
Right.
So I don't see how I can supersede a notice that we put out that was a petition by two other
people.
No, but
we have to vote on that, right? We voted to put it out for public comment,
yep.
and it's out for public comment,
yes.
and in fact, the deadline came and went a few weeks ago.
That's not on the agenda today.
Right. But what I'm asking is that is going to come for a vote of whether or not we open a rulemaking. That's the next step, right?
Yes. But that petition also addresses other topics that are not addressed in this document. So, yes, you're going to have to vote on that one, too.
Oh, I can't wait. So is that, are you going to vote on that but peel out the coordination part? Because it seems to me, as I said, that this proposal that you circulated for today appears to be a more detailed version of paragraph 4, again, ensuring the independence of independent expenditures.
As I said, that notice of availability is now acquired a life of its own. It's in response to a petition from people who don't sit at this table, and nothing that I do in making a proposal today is going to supersede what happens with that petition. That petition will eventually come back to us for a vote as to whether we should open a rulemaking.
Right, and I'm asking you, are you going
issues.
To vote to open a rulemaking on this section, or does this supersede that?
And I just said it does not supersede that. I've said it three times now,
okay.
I believe.
Okay.
And that petition, as I said, will address other issues that are not present in this document.
Okay. So there was a request to
withdraw my motion so that my colleagues can have more time to think about it.
All right. So we will put this matter on the next open agenda in December. Thank you. Okay. And then there are a few more items that relate to this rulemaking priorities and proposals that we have not discussed. We discuss 15-54A, and then there is 15-54B, and draft notice of proposed rulemaking on technical modernization. Excuse me?
B is the party secretary.
Oh, is it? Okay, I've got it incorrectly then here. Sorry. This is 15-54C, and it's the draft notice of proposed rulemaking on technical modernization, and we have with us Jessica, excuse me? Let's come back to B afterwards. Jessica Selenkoff, here. Would you like to make a presentation, please?
Thank you, Chair Ravel. When the commission was established, most contributions and disbursements were made by check with carbon copies. These were likely sent by postal mail. Business records were on paper, and written communications were delivered by postal mail or, for the technologically forward, fax. Today, a financial transaction can be entirely electronic. A payment can be made by credit or debit card through internet-based payment processors, online banking, or text message. A payment can be transferred to a Bitcoin wallet. A check can be can be deposited on your smartphone through your bank's app with no paper moving at all. And the records of these transactions may be in a screenshot, an email, or other electronic record with images, text, or emoji. The draft notice of proposed rulemaking in agenda document 1554C, also known as hashtag TechMod, and as technological modernization, not technical modernization, proposes revisions to over 100 commission regulations, from administrative regulations in Part 1 through regulations that implement the Federal Election Campaign Act, such as the conduit and forwarding rules that were and are at issue in the advisory opinion discussed today, to the public finance regulations at Part 9039, to address, among other things, the receipt, deposit, forwarding, and record keeping of electronic transactions. The notice also proposes eliminating references to outdated technologies such as telegrams and updating references to computer and internet terminology such as World Wide Web and websites, two words. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. That was very succinct given the length of this document. Yeah. Are there any questions? Questions by any members of the commission or Commissioner Goodman?
Ms. Selenkoff, this is admirable, and a lot of work went into this, and I know you've spent a lot of time reading treatises on the distinctions of technology. So I just want to commend you on putting together a very complicated piece of work. We lawyers don't always understand the technologies behind what we regulate, and so this is a very good first step, I think. So I just want to commend you for a good piece of work, and you, Mr. Noddy, as well. I have some questions on page 44, for example, on bitcoins. You choose the phrase digital currencies. I always thought of these digital I call them alternative media of exchange. I'm not sure. What is the definition of currency versus a medium of exchange? I thought that was one thing we struggled with, was whether this was currency of the United States, whether to treat it like cash. And I didn't know if we were already biasing the subject by using the word currency with respect to these bitcoins and other digital currencies. I thought we might say bitcoin or other digital or alternative mediums of exchange.
the document is not intended to presume the answer to whether or not this is currency. I know that that's an issue that the Commission addressed in the two Bitcoin advisory opinions it considered last year and the year before. I think the term digital currency was intended to be used as it's used by other entities that are considering these issues right now. The FinCEN uses the term and has defined and explored that term. Academic writers are exploring it as to the economic theory as to whether or not it's currency or a commodity, for example.
Property.
I don't think this document was intended to answer that question for our purposes. Mm-hmm. I know, again, that's an issue the Commission struggled with and grappled with previously before deciding to not necessarily answer the question, but to treat Bitcoin via our framework for in-kind contribution reporting.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry.
Mr. Noddy was pointing out that the statute and the regs use the terms currency of the United States or of a foreign nation, I believe, is the other term.
Yes, it does.
This is not pretending to change that definition.
I'm not sure in the citations to footnote 88 you have here, and I apologize, I did not pull it before before coming to hear your presentation today, but I do recall that there was a Treasury statement at some point, and it may be one of the cited documents here, where the Treasury concluded that Bitcoins are property and not currency. Is that the conclusion of one of these items that's cited here?
No, that's the IRS gave guidance as to the treatment of Bitcoin as a, I believe it was similar to a commodity. And not as currency. I believe that's what you're referring to.
Yes.
But the FinCEN citation in this footnote is the one that I was referencing earlier.
And what does that one conclude?
That is the one that used currency in scare quotes. It used currency scare as quotes. It's used in this footnote within
also
scare quotes.
Also known as holding your nose at the use of the term, yes. I just wonder if we ought to consider in this draft being a little, not using the word currency so quickly and freely, given that I just know that it's been the Treasury Department's position that it is not a currency. It is not money. It is property.
Did you want to respond?
It just is really my comment, as we ought to consider that. I'm not proposing an amendment to anything today, but I think we ought to consider being very careful in the words we choose, because we know that the second we start putting it in the box of currency, while I understand the regulation says currency of the United States, some people take the word currency and take liberties with that. So I think we have to be very careful about that. As you know, there was a disagreement among commissioners on whether to limit it like currency of the United States to $100. And if it is just property, and it is an in-kind, then some of us believe that the limits of contributions differs dramatically from the $100 limit. So that's why I'm concerned with the language that we use.
Do you have further questions?
I have others, but I don't
go. No, does anybody else? Commissioner Weintraub.
I'll just comment that I just did a quick Google, and I found several websites that refer to Bitcoin as digital currency. So I don't, they didn't make this stuff up.
Yeah, well, certainly websites and are free to, I don't know what sources you are, but I would source at least, and as we did previously as we debated, you know, we did cite the Treasury Department's position that it's property and not currency. Let me ask about somewhere in here, I believe it's on page 61. Are you talking about expanding the definition of public communication to include internet-enabled devices or applications? So, in other words, right now, if I pay an advertising fee to post my political ad as a box ad or some other form on somebody else's website, we treat that as a regulated expenditure, right?
It would be defined as a public communication.
Public communication. And if it's a for-fee advertisement, we regulate that.
As a public communication, that would be subject to the rules for federal election activity, for coordination,
mm-hmm.
and for the disclaimer
and for
rules.
Disclosure and IEs and all of those purposes. So what you're proposing here is that, I'm sorry, you're not proposing it. What this document proposes for public comment, I want to be clear, I'm not attributing that you've decided any of these issues, is that we ask the public whether we should expand our definition of public communication to regulate not just websites, but internet-enabled devices and applications?
I'm not sure everyone would say expand is the correct word there, only because it's intended to recognize that when the commission adopted the word website in the definition of public communication in 2006, it explained in other parts of that document the commission's understanding of that term to include podcasts, for example, certain messaging apps or applications. I don't think the word app was quite in common usage in 2006. And this document would propose to revise the rule text to reflect that reality as it's currently experienced.
Okay. So if we're going to, instead of, I won't use the word, the pejorative, expand, clarify, perhaps, if we're going to clarify that we're going to now regulate for-fee, and I can't imagine all the ways it's not just banner advertising in an application, for example, right? I mean, applications may disseminate political information through ways other than a traditional website ad. I could pay to have a game, for example, that is how to elect Jim Smith for president, right? I mean, it could be a whole application. But if I'm paying to do that, we would then regulate that like we would a banner ad on a website. That's what the clarification asked for comment from.
If it were paid to a third party's
right.
application.
So I pay an app provider to create a game.
If it's your own app that you're creating, that would not be included in the proposed definition. The back-end payments, for example, that I believe that you're asking about,
mm-hmm.
Were not contemplated as being included. It would still remain as currently defined, where it's as currently defined, a public communication excludes communications on the internet except for those placed for a fee on a third person's or another person's website. That framework would remain.
So in other words, it would still have to be a third party's app.
Correct.
Or internet-enabled device.
Correct. Yeah. It would still be a type of the general public political communication that's contemplated currently.
Is this the full gamut, internet-enabled devices and applications? Because I think of other things, but I know you've been reading the treatises, like platforms. There are things, aren't they, that are perhaps a hybrid between a website and an application? Or are they all going to fall within, as long as we're in the process of updating, internet-enabled device or application, are there other things?
There may be, and that is actually a particular question that would be most interested in hearing from the outside world about is how to what is the universe and how do we capture it accurately in regulatory text. And just to take a step back for a second, the purpose of this proposal is not to change the commission's regulations. It's to take, so in the regulation that's being discussed right now, it says website. The word that's used is website. And in 2015, that word, it's unclear and confusing to everybody, commissioners and the outside world. What does website mean in 2015 when communications are happening in non-web internet formats? So the purpose of that and many of the other proposals is to make the wording of the regulations sufficiently flexible that the commission doesn't have to so that the commission can apply the regulations case by case in the future as new technologies arise without having to struggle with inherently obsolete language in the regulations themselves.
No, I get the drill, and I appreciate it, but I guess I'm just trying to understand. So, in other words, we would field test internet-enabled device and application, and see if that carries the water.
We ask a question to asking a question in this document as to whether there is better terminology. Some of the problems are that you have software applications, you have an app. The terminology itself is hard to settle on for regulatory language. What we came up with, we hope, would provide the flexibility that Mr. Noddy discussed, while still getting specific enough that people understand that we're talking about an internet-enabled Xbox, as well as where there have been political advertisements already that have been disclosed, as well as an app, as well as a website, and perhaps other technologies.
I suppose, though, that political commentary or advocacy in an application may take on a different form than just a paid advertisement. That's, I guess, applications operate in so many different ways, it may not show up as a banner ad. And I think we just need to think through all the ways that people use data now, for example. And embedded in the data is perhaps an application that people subscribe to, and somehow your advocacy is making it through to those people, and whether we're going to regulate that like a paid advertisement versus something else. Applications just operate differently, and the banner ad doesn't look the same through an app necessarily as it does on the old website. If we do test drive internet-enabled device or application to clarify instead of expand the regulatory field of what is regulated as a paid public communication, are we also going to test taking the same language into all the exceptions? For example, where there is an exception under 100.94 and 100.155, where there is an exception to coordination under the definition of the definition, are we going to take whenever we arrive at new language, are we going to provide the same clarification on all the things and communications that the commission has already exempted, and make it a corollary, make the corollary change, or does that not fit because different language, for example, 100.94 and 155 have the broad term internet activities, and in those regulations, they currently define internet activities differently than you would see elsewhere. So I guess I'm asking, should we also be carrying this language and have it ripple through everywhere we address the internet?
The voluntary internet exceptions that you're discussing do define internet activity as a subset of various online activity. But they also, as far as the coordination provisions that you discuss, incorporate the definition of public communication. So in answer to your question, yes, this would be carried over into that by nature of the proposed revision to the definition of public communication would be applied in that context. Additionally, other exceptions, such as the de minimis exception to federal election activity, mm-hmm. would also, where it's not incorporated by the definition of public communication, for example, but separately may create an exception for certain website activity. This draft does also propose to amend that provision as well, so as to
provide the exception
to apps.
Idiosyncrasy. I mean, in other words, it goes into that regulation and expands the language.
Yes, because the definition of public communication isn't the.
The doesn't wag
term
the whole
there
dog
as it
there,
is
right.
in the internet the voluntary internet exception.
Okay, I may have missed it, but the press exemption talks about websites. The commission put websites into the press exemption, but I didn't see that here. So would we, since we're already discussing websites, would we clarify in the press exemption internet-enabled devices or applications as well there?
I have to refresh my memory of that provision.
Let's look at it real quick. I thought I had it.
It does reference website, capital W, two words.
So I understand on our global change, we would change the press exemption to change the spelling website to be one word, right?
I don't believe that the document proposes incorporating apps there as a means of conveying a news story, editorial commentary. I think it,
I have used applications on my Samsung.
I think it could be amended if you so chose. Absolutely.
Okay. I need more time to sort of think through that language. I haven't, Madam Chair, again,
yes.
I don't mean to
no.
Monopolize the questions.
It looks like everyone else has tuned out, so you go ahead.
Okay, well, then,
just kidding.
For the benefit of whoever's listening at home, because no one's listening here, let me ask you one thing that I didn't see, there have been a lot of payment processing AOs, and it looks like you try to harmonize those here, or at least put out for comment that to turn those into a rulemaking. We've also had a lot of AOs, including one today, regarding online and web-based platforms for giving. Indeed, today's is an application. The one before us today was both a website platform as well as an application. You could participate in it either way. Is there any thought to whether we should address platforms for associating, obtaining information, recommendations, and donating through this vehicle? We've got Skimmerhat, Repledge, Brook, CrowdPack. We've got the one that we handled today.
I'm going to defer to Mr. Lutz, who focused on the proposed revisions to the conduit and forwarding rules for that section of the document.
Thank you, Mr. Lutz.
So, yes, the document does try to address and incorporate some of those advisory opinions and those conclusions.
What pages should I be looking at, Theo?
Pages 34 through 39.
34 to 39. Okay, I do see them. I'm sorry. I just worked through it and missed those. But do you address at all the issue that we addressed today? Would that be...
Are you referring to who the service would be provided to?
Who the service is provided to, and whether or not limiting working one side of the fence, for example, would somehow convert you as not working for the user of your application, but working for the political committee?
Yeah, that's on page 37.
Page 37. And how
the current regulations and the exception to the definition of conduit don't squarely address all of the types of transactions that have come before the commission, and we're trying to revise the regulations to give space for those types of proposals.
Okay, I'll have to study this one a little more closely, but thank you for drawing my attention to it, Theo. Let me ask a couple of questions then. About record-keeping requirements. And beginning on about page 10, you know, we recognize, I think, that people keep records a little differently, but some campaigns, especially small congressional campaigns, are not completely digitized. So Let me ask you, what do we mean by retrievable and reviewable in oral form? And what kinds of records were we considering that inspired that language, retrievable and reviewable in oral form?
What page and line?
I believe it's page 10, starting at line 15, but I'm not sure that that language comes from that page. Bear with me, page 10.
Oh, it's 18.
Page 18?
It's line 18.
Oh, line 18.
On page 10.
Okay.
So this is in the proposed definition of record.
Right.
For those who aren't following along in the document. And as a preliminary matter, it doesn't require the use of electronic records. It is just an attempt to provide the space for including those electronic records that people do keep within the definition. We are trying to anticipate, based on a number of sources, the sorts of records that could be kept for FEC purposes, and used on page 9 in footnotes 23 through 27, it lists the sources we looked at from which we drafted potential language for the Commission's consideration, including the rules of evidence, the federal rules of evidence, the federal rules of civil procedure, Black's Law Dictionary, and then two other sources that focus on electronic records, the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act, and and the eSign Act.
Madam Chair, may I?
Yes, Mr. Noddy.
Just add one consideration. Nothing in these proposals is intended to foreclose the ability of entities that are permitted to file on paper and submit on paper, the ones that are allowed to under the existing regulations. Nothing is intended to remove that ability from them.
Or to maintain records in paper.
Correct.
If people just aren't ready to go all digital.
If they're allowed to. The regulations don't allow everybody to make all submissions electronically.
Submissions. I'm talking about the records back in home office, but back in the campaign headquarters.
Correct.
Right. In other words, if you want to stay in paper, you can stay in paper. We're just updating that if you're going digital, here we would begin to adapt language and again, seek comment on how to do that.
Yes.
Okay. Let me ask you, have we contemplated in this questions to the public about what happens if you're changing hardware, software, and the computer eats your paper? Obviously, that can happen in paper form, too. You can have a fire. You can have a lot of things. But have we considered and have we put out questions that or is there already precedent in the agency? I just don't know about what happens when you're required to keep records for 3 years. And we update regs to say, okay, we are going to recognize the keeping of records in digital form. What happens when the computer eats the document? What happens when a vendor has a computer crash? What happens? I mean, I'm just wondering if we should ask those types of questions and whether digital records present different issues of best efforts and negligence and the obligation to keep records for 3 years.
The document before you does not propose any changes to the existing approaches the Commission would take towards that problem.
Remind me what the current approach is in the paper world.
If there is a software error from the Commission's perspective.
Actually, let's start with paper world. There's a fire. What's our rule? I don't know.
I'm not sure there is one, and this does not propose any changes to that.
Yeah, that's I guess I'm looking for the baseline.
There are best efforts guidelines that we have issued regarding that.
Mm-hmm.
And certain defenses in the context of an administrative fine, for example, that are in the regulations, this does not propose to alter those.
Do you have a question, Commissioner?
I would just think we need to think through a secondary set of questions. The second we begin endorsing and the use of digital, there are a lot of other issues that go with that. Retrievability, We just ought to ask the questions if we're going to address the issue. For example, retrievability. What happens if it's in a exotic software that the commission cannot open? Who has to pay to convert that document? Just issues like that. In the paper world, those issues are pretty clear. You got paper, we can send our auditors in, they can look at it.
The retrievability issue is in there.
It is.
It's actually, that's currently in some existing regulations as well, specifically in the public financing context, where our auditors have, for decades, been dealing with committees' computer systems. And I believe that it's currently in the regulations with respect to another digital record provision as well. The proposed definitions do require or do address retrievability, by requiring persons to provide the commission with software in all circumstances, but to provide the commission the software to make a record retrievable upon our request.
At their expense.
Which would be the current approach that exists now in the other contexts.
In paper context, they have to pay the expense of what?
No, in the current retrievability provisions that are in the regulations.
Currently, the current regulations say that if I have it in an outdated form of software, I have to pay for the conversion for the commission's use?
It requires the software personnel in the public financing context to be provided, if necessary, to make the record retrievable. If you look on page 11 of the draft, the existing provisions that discuss retrievability are referenced there with the proposal to remove those provisions because the comparable provision would be incorporated into the proposed definition of record. And that's at around lines 8 to 13. Page 11.
Page 11? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Walter, did you have a question?
I was just wondering, there must be a slug of agencies that are struggling with the same issue, and I'm wondering if the if you've taken a look at what other agencies are doing, or if there is some kind of uniform policy that's being suggested or used or experimented with in other agencies, just to see if there's we can learn from what other people are doing.
We have looked at, in some respects, at model rules and the like. That's how, for example, the two of the sources that I mentioned earlier regarding the definition of record, but also that we're using with respect to the definition of, or the proposed definition of signature, come from model rules or other federal legislation. So as far as every detail of this, many of them, as far as the specific means of processing electronic transactions may be specific to us, but we're looking, for example, to FinCEN for some of the issues we discussed earlier with respect to Bitcoin or to the IRS. And we have looked at how other financial regulatory agencies have addressed some of these other issues. The document, I believe, in one respect references certain Know Your Customer laws that apply in the banking situation. Not with respect to every proposal in here, though.
Did you have something to add, Mr. Noddy?
I just want to add that we also discussed these ideas and proposals at various stages in the process with the agency's own internal experts in compliance, in audit, in RAD, and IT, and actually, I'm sure I'm forgetting some, but
every part of the agency.
Everybody. Compliance advice, enforcement. So this reflects, although there wasn't consensus on everything, this does reflect input from the folks who, both inside the building, who really know about these issues.
I have to commend you for the amazing amount of work, really good work that went into this document. It's really exhaustive and thoughtful, and obviously what you've talked about talking to everybody in the commission about it was really obviously time consuming, but added to it being a really, really excellent document. And I also have to commend you, Ms. Selikoff, for your recall of the details of what's in here, including the page and line. So I really appreciate your presentation today. I know you have some issues that you want, or can we have a motion on this? I mean, it is a proposed rulemaking, and it's an opportunity for us to hear from the public as well. So, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me also echo the kudos to Ms. Selikoff and Mr. Lotz. This is a first-rate piece of work, and I think this is a very worthwhile undertaking, I think, not only for the kind of terminological updates that it provides, but there are a number of areas which have what immediately comes to mind, text message contributions, has been the subject of numerous advisory opinions, and I think having some ability to harmonize those for rulemaking will be, I think, especially useful to the regulated community and others who fall within our ambit. The one area that I need to look a little closer at, and Commissioner Goodman spoke about this a little bit as well, is the issue about internet payment processing platforms is an evolving one. I believe in the time that since this document was first forwarded to the commission, we've had democracy rules repledge. We still have FYP that's still a live matter. And I just need to go back and look at those just to see if there may need to be any modifications, updates, additions to reflect some of the most recent developments. And so I think that's one thing that I'd like to look at before we have a vote, just to make sure that we're as complete as possible. But I again want to commend you for answering our questions, for putting together I think what is a very solid draft, and hopefully we can make some movement on this very soon.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Well, then, hearing no further discussion, we'll bring it back on the next meeting in December. Thank you. And I skipped, so we have to go back to the previous document, which was the 15-54A, the outline of draft NPRM implementing parties. I'm sorry. B, we did that one, which is, it's just... The way my document is written is confusing to me. Outline of draft NPRM implementing party segregated accounts. Thank you, Mr. Stepanovich.
Thank you, and good afternoon, commissioners. Before you is agenda document 15-54-B, which was held over from the October 29 and November 10 open meetings. And this document is a memorandum to the commission from the Office of the General Counsel outlining a possible notice of proposed rulemaking for implementing party segregated accounts. This outline addresses potential proposed regulatory changes in response to certain provisions in two pieces of legislation passed by Congress: the Consolidated and Further Continuing Appropriations Act, which amended the Federal Election Campaign Act by establishing separate limits on contributions to three types of segregated accounts of national party committees, and the Gabriella Miller Kids First Research Act, which amended the Presidential Election Campaign Fund Act by terminating the entitlement of the National Party Committees to public funds to finance their presidential nominating conventions. Thank you, and I'll be happy to address any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions, Mr. Stepanovich? Commissioner Goodman.
Last year, the commission approved a advisory opinion to the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee that recognized that convention committees satisfied the definition of political committee and that they could be created. Now, what was interesting to me about that was I expected the Office of General Counsel to write a yes draft and for the commission to congeal around a yes draft. that created a new account for the political committees to run their conventions, much like the commission had previously established or approved new accounts for recounts and legal activities post-election. But that wasn't the approach that we took as a commission. Instead, we recognized a whole new paradigm that these convention committees could be standalone political committees. I saw nothing in the legislation granting the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee new accounts that would undo that rationale. In fact, they still have utility for convention committees. If the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee want to raise money into a convention account that Congress created for them, they may not want to enter into all the contracts that it takes to put on a convention. They may want to transfer that money over to their convention committee, which they would be able to do under our advisory opinion and working in harmony with the new law that created the new fundraising account. So as I read this, it proposes that somehow the legislation mooted the accounts. Excuse me. The account legislation mooted the committees as standalone political committees. Could you elaborate on that? And am I wrong in interpreting this proposal?
Sure. So, well, first of all, that's certainly a question that the commission will have to grapple with in any rulemaking that it undertakes. So this was a kind of a preliminary thought process that we had. It's not an actual proposed rulemaking just yet. But that advisory opinion has to be looked at in context of when it was asked. And it was asked before the Appropriations Act was passed by Congress. So it was asked after the Gabriela Miller Research Act was passed. So there was a gap in the statute there. And at that time, we didn't have commission accounts. Subsequently, Congress stepped in and filled the gap statutorily. So our initial take was that by creating these commission accounts, that it created higher limits for spending for convention expenses. Made the advisory opinion a moot point, like you pointed out.
Well, I read the in this draft. I won't call it your proposal. It's a draft for consideration, and it certainly addresses the purpose for which the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee walked in this door and asked the commission for an advisory opinion. Yes, the legislation had abolished the public funding for the conventions, and subsequently new accounts were created, but we didn't choose the account paradigm. So I guess what that is not grappled with in this draft. This draft relies on the purpose for which the DNC and the RNC walked on our door and asked the question, to fill the gap. And so what is it in the appropriations bill and the creation of the new accounts that indicated that they wanted to change this commission's analysis of what constitutes a political party committee?
There's nothing in the legislation that refers to the AO, but it's not just the view reflected in the draft is not just that the purpose was mooted out, but that the actual factual underpinnings of that AO included the absence of a funding source that had historically been a separate funding source that had historically been available to the parties. And that one of the facts that was critical to the commission in issuing that advisory opinion was the absence of that historical funding source. So the commission issued the AO, but then Congress changed that fundamental fact by providing a separate and actually more expansive funding source for that activity, therefore removing or mooting or whatever word you want to use, that critical fact of the advisory opinion.
Now, hold on. It was a critical fact of why they wanted an advisory opinion, but it was not a fact that underlay our political committee analysis in that advisory opinion. In other words, we didn't say that a convention committee meets the definition of political committee because Congress shut down public funding for conventions. We said, look at the definition of what a political party committee would be. A convention committee would meet that definition. We didn't say that it meets that definition because Congress eliminated public funding for the national parties to run conventions.
I think part of the reason that the commission approved those committees was because of the absence of public funding.
It may have been one of the political reasons why we mustered four votes to address it, but it's not one of the legal rationale reasons given for why a convention meets the definition of political committee. Let me ask you this, then. We don't have to settle this today. I've raised the issue, and I think that's sufficient.
Yeah.
What happens to convention committees under this proposal? Can the DNC and the RNC still operate convention committees separate and apart from the RNC and DNC and transfer money from the convention account that Congress created to these separate committees, even if it's for the purpose of administrative ease, for having contracts and, you know, having contracts with a venue and a forum and all the things that it does, rather than having all those contracts have to be entered by the DNC and the RNC? What happens to convention committees under this draft?
That's a good point. Under our proposal, a lot of the convention committee regulations would go away because we didn't think that they would be necessary. That said, the National Party Committee could establish a committee, call it commission committee, but it just wouldn't be wouldn't have a separate contribution limit. So I suppose if it wanted to do things through a separate entity, probably could do so.
Is that addressed currently in this draft?
No, we don't go into that.
We would have to work on that, right?
Work through that, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I was just going to suggest that the document that we have in front of us is an outline of a draft, notice of a proposed rulemaking, and it's at a very early stage. I think that you raise some interesting questions that could very fairly be posed in the actual notice of proposed rulemaking, and we could get comments and we could talk about it some more and consider what we think the answers are. But we don't have to resolve them today in order to start the process of allowing our regulations to recognize all of these increased amounts of money that party committees can raise. This should make you very happy, Commissioner Goodman.
Yeah. And let me sort of piggyback on that. I mean, I agree with that point, but also I want to emphasize, as I was the fourth vote in that AO, that the conclusion was based in significant part on the party's need for new convention committees to, and I quote, operate in the same space as publicly financed convention committees had operated prior to the Research Act. So I want to concur with what's been said here today, that was the basis for my fourth vote in that matter.
Well, the parties have the advisory opinion. Right? The parties have it, and they have the protection of the majority opinion. And you can announce, Madam Chair, that you've changed your mind now.
And I'm not announcing anything.
Okay, well, then they have the protection of the advisory opinions right now, and they can operate separate convention committees if they so choose under the advisory opinion that they have. And I guess I'm concerned that of beginning down the road of drafting a proposal that would reverse the protections that the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee already have under an existing advisory opinion based on a legal theory that an Appropriations Act filled some political motivation for issuing it but didn't alter the legal analysis of that advisory opinion. Let me ask another question about, can you refer me, Nevin, to the pages on what's contemplated here for the recount, election contest, and other legal proceedings. Can you point me to the right page again? I see. It's page 8. Is that right? C?
Yes, that's correct. It starts with page 8.
Let me start with nomenclature. Why do we call them recount accounts? Because the language of the legislation was far broader than recounts. Other legal proceedings. It seems to me under the statutory language or the legislative language of other legal proceeding, this commission would have great leeway to approve a lot of other legal expenses of the parties other than just recount. So starting by calling it a recount account, while it might have met some historical approval of this commission through advisory opinion, it seems to me that Congress took it a step further than just recounts. Legal compliance, state administrative law, civil rights law, litigation prior or in conjunction with an election, election administration litigation, legal advice on compliance with the FECA. I mean, are we prepared? What is this proposal proposed to put in and out of this legal proceeding account?
Commissioner, that whole section starting on page 8 discusses what would be included. The phrase recount account is a defined term, simply a shorthand, because we didn't want to say the phrase election recounts and contests and other legal proceedings every single time we referred to the...
We could just call it legal account.
We could, but it's just a heading in a memo. The actual regulatory text outline talks about the inclusion, and it's quite clear that it would propose to include more than just recounts.
Okay, no, I see that now. Thanks for calling my attention to it. Let me ask you this. What legal expense would be excluded from this account? And would the salary of the General Counsel of the Democratic National Committee be in or out?
Under our proposal, what would specifically be prohibited would be to make independent expenditures or contributions or for general campaign expenses.
General what?
Campaign expenses.
Okay, so campaigning and electoral advocacy is out, but would all other legal expenses be in the account? Would the RNC and the DNC be able to take their legal shops? As long as they're not engaging in express advocacy and going out and knocking on doors, if they're performing legal work for the committees, would all of that cost function be within the proper use of the legal accounts?
I think that we would have to work through that through our rulemaking as we're drafting the proposed document and seeking public comment as well. This document doesn't go into that kind of detail.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you. Those are all my questions right now.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chair, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe when Commissioner Goodman first introduced his regulatory relief proposal back in October, he had mentioned that notwithstanding some of the reservations that he had about some of the directions that this might be going, or maybe just a few nits here and there, he'd be willing to, as part of a larger deal, move forward to drafting the NPRMs at that point, and I agreed with him. Since that proposal has not borne fruit as of yet, and that this would be considered more kind of as a standalone, I think that in an effort to try to give as much quality direction to the Office of General Counsel about an NPRM that might have the greatest chance of success, I think that I want to look through this and maybe propose some changes. One of the realities when we do a rulemaking is that whatever we get is kind of the first draft of the NPRM, but even though we can edit it as freely as we wish from that point, but oftentimes it serves as the baseline, and sometimes if there's a problem that one side or the other has with the baseline document, it can be somewhat difficult to modify or add to or edit or delete or what have you. And so in order to try to maybe address some of those things at the outset so that you know, whatever instruction we give to OGC gives it the best chance of succeeding as possible. I think that there are a few little things in this document that I would like to maybe tweak, modify, and just update so that, and I realize, as Commissioner Weintraub said, this is an outline of a draft, NPRM, and there's going to be plenty more whacks at the... Oh, yeah, there's going to be plenty more whacks at this pinata, but there's, you know, there's going to be some, I think, merit in modifying
this. Is that an incentive?
What's that?
Yeah, and that's not a very good comparison. The pinata gets broken and falls all over the floor.
I know, but all sorts of goodies spill out.
The goodies spill out. Yes. Yeah, they
do. And that's we want. True. We want nothing but goodness.
We do want goodness.
To be all over
candy for everybody.
That can be edifying to all. So I would ask that we also be able to pick this up at the next meeting.
All right, that sounds good.
But hope that we can move forward at that
I
point.
I appreciate it, you know, it sounds like you might have everyone some extensive changes to it. So if you can get it, the sooner the better would be really great.
And could I suggest that this kind of nitty-gritty, you know, on page 47, line 14, what did you mean by this word, that those kinds of comments are actually a lot easier to deal with by emailing the staff and copying all the commissioners and their staff so everybody can look at it. And it's not, you know, it doesn't make for a very scintillating meeting for us to be going through the document and writing it at the table with those kinds of corrections.
Well, unlike The Daily Show, I didn't intend to be scintillating or comedic here. There is a public and there is a press sitting here. And so
lost one.
Well, hearing there are many, some of them listen at home or at their computers. So this is their opportunity also to hear the questions and see some of the finer issues raised at the commission. So
imagine
there is a public disclosure purpose for discussing some of this at the table, since it is a public document. And I'm just this is a good and it's one point where we're all gathered together, and you get the benefit of hearing some of my concerns. I could sandbag your own concerns. You've criticized me for
emails.
That as well.
I would read every one of your emails. I promise.
All right. Well, why don't we move on to the next item?